This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Front Row on the Bigger Picture, and I'm Lim Soon Heng. It is hard to believe that we are at the last of our series on music through time. Kevin Field from Bentley Music Academy Malaysia has taken us from medieval music to Renaissance to Baroque to classical to romantic, and today we dance to modern music.
Yeah, we've done all of that all in less than 6 hours total. That's quite extraordinary.
Yeah. Well, to contextualize the modern, the impulses which started in the late 19th century, during this period, we have folks like T.S. Eliot, an Anglophile American, published The Wasteland, a poem in 5 parts, Ezra Pound's Cantos. Other poets include E.E. Cummings, Robert Frost, Dylan Thomas, Yeats, writers like Joseph Conrad, Hart Crane, Faulkner, F. Scott Fitzgerald of The Great Gatsby, Ernest Hemingway. It's a period that's very, very rich. And then, of course, in terms of politics, Karl Marx, Sigmund Freud, and two great wars.
Yes. Two almost milestone this period to some extent, and the knock-on effect of certainly the First World War on composers, is what we're talking about, was huge. But how do you – we're coming back to that same question, is where do you draw the line in the sand again with this period?
And that's why I wanted to ask you this question about folks like Mahler, Strauss, Sibelius, Debussy. Where would you place them?
Or neo-romantics to some extent, or neoclassicists. I mean, they do a bit of everything. I was just listening to presenting the first movement of Mahler 7 to my conducting students. And actually listen to that first movement, you think, how on earth did that composer write that? Well, carry in his head, then have the discipline to write it all down, and then transfer that information to an orchestra of 120 people, players, and an orchestra, a piece that lasts so long. Absolutely extraordinary. But what you're touching on is the variety in this period, because obviously we're bringing it up right to contemporary period. But you've still got people like, yes, Mahler, you've got Poulenc, Puccini, Rachmaninoff. They're still writing very tonal music. I'm going to use this term, which I'm going to regret forever, box office-friendly music. I'm sorry about that. We'll explain that a bit later. Compared to where another quarter was going towards 12-tone serialist music, which is just almost counter music.
And the melody is so much harder to hum.
Absolutely. Yeah, nothing. There's nothing whistle. No, you could whistle at the end of the show in that sense, yeah.
We've mentioned the fact that during this period, there was the First World War, Second World War. What were the people thinking about? What were the intellectuals you think were fascinated with during this time?
I tend to think that they're going to just try and, well, certainly I'm British, so we tend to just crack on with it and get on with it, you know, and keep the routines going. You can't get away from the sheer dark influence of what was going on in that period and what it was having on the psyche. Even though we were getting on with day-to-day events, I think there's no way you can, you know, ignore that in any way, but certainly artistically as a composer.
I guess it's no different with what's going on right now in the United States, with what's going on in the White House, and folks are trying to get on with it.
Yes, you could go back to the 70s, 80s. You look at the operas of John Adams, for example. They're sort of called the CNN operas because they reflect those sort of contemporary news items of the day. You've got the opera Killinghofer, Nixon in China, Dr. Atomic, which deals with Oppenheimer and discovering, you know, how to use nuclear energy and as a bomb in that sense. You know, so it would be very interesting to work with a composer right now and say, okay, what would you be writing now based on the information that you have to hand? Because this information is coming, obviously, by default, by technology, everything is coming to us much faster, isn't it? So we get the access to that information, whereas at the beginning of, you know, the beginning of the last century, I keep thinking we're still in the, you know, never mind, that shows our age. You know, you're still talking about, you know, you're talking about the telephone. The telephone is only just, you know, wasn't it? It was just coming into being in the previous century, the start of the previous century. So from there to where we are now, we could barely fly just over 100 years ago. You know, the technological changes, massive.
when we were talking about the Romantic period, we talked about music that was more emotional. We were talking about music that tries to be transcendent and reaching out to a
beauty
realm
without bounds.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
What would characterize the 20th century music?
I've got a quote here. It's avoiding traditional forms, avoiding all traditional forms of beauty. Yin Yang, you're complete opposite of what it is that we were dealing with the Romantic period. And that's partly to do with noise. We're talking about noise. We've had this discussion off air about noise being involved. And that became a genuine content, a factor of content that composers used. And in almost in the one piece by John Cage called 4 Minutes 33 Seconds, which we could never air on the radio because it is 4 Minutes 33 Seconds of silence. It can be played on any instrument. You get dressed up as if you're going to deliver a concert. You can stand at a piano or a music stand and with your trombone or whatever and stand there for 4 minutes.
But nobody performs.
Nobody performs because he was after absolute silence. And this is coming from all the noise. This is coming from the noise of the First, Second World War, the 12-tone serialist, which we must touch on in terms of harmony. So he was trying to get this absolute, absolute, absolute silence in music, free of noise. But what he found was he couldn't do it because, like almost in this studio,
something would intrude.
Something is happening. You can hear, or he could hear, his blood circulating around. You can hear that. And you put your headphones on, and then he was told that actually what you can hear is your nervous system, the zing to some extent. So that's tinnitus for some of us. You know, our bodies vibrate. Our bodies make noise. So there's no absolute silence in that sense. But going back to that noise element, music concrete as a source material. So making music out of everyday sounds, whether that is, excuse me, this pen. Like if you go to a Stomp concert, what do they make music out of? In the Stomp show, they make it out of trash. But they're making
trash
music.
Trash bins, yeah.
Yes, yeah, they're making music. So anything goes. Anything goes in this period.
But that's closer to our period when musicians have to use these trash bins. Mm. But even before we come to this period, we have Stravinsky in 1913.
Champs-Élysées Theatre and the premiere of Rite of Spring, the ballet score. It caused a riot. And there is an urban, I don't know if it is an urban myth or what, but somebody apparently threw themselves off the balcony because of the sheer noise and the, you know, of what they were hearing.
Today, Rite of Spring is performed by an orchestra in a proper auditorium.
It's standard repertoire. Yeah. Yes, yes.
Why
yes.
was it so radical? What made it so radical that folks, like even say it's maybe apocryphal, that somebody would commit suicide based on this music?
Because you're coming out of a fairly standard meat and two veg romantic period to some extent, harmonically quite safe, quite logical, rhythmically quite straight and four square. So what he starts to do is he gets literally very earthy with rhythms and repetition. What we're dealing with in previous periods is an abstract music which is making an argument, exposing an idea, developing that idea, resolving that idea.
That's the sonata for one.
Yes, absolutely, yes. We're not necessarily dealing with that now. We're just dealing with arguments for argument's sake. Now, whether that's an abstract piece of music, a standalone piece of music in its own right, or whether it's for ballet or for film, we're dealing with a change in the use of the harmony, orchestration, and form. We've discussed this before. Berlioz would have had the same resistance, would have received the same resistance from audiences, for sure. There are composers today that still receive that kind of resistance because it's new. We are afraid of the new. And this was very new. I mean, that you could say that that's the start of modern music or 20th century music, 1913, but you could actually go back to Debussy, Prelude à la Promenade d'Enfants, and that's from 1894. And just listen to that first descending flute phrase. We don't know what key we're in. That's 18, so you can take it right back to there. So where is that line in the sand? Somewhere around there, but certainly by the middle of the First, Second World War,
for
sure.
What were they trying to do? I know they were trying to break form, but I suspect people don't break form for the sake of breaking form. There must be something that is driving that. Is it a rejection of romantic music as being too pretty or too melodic and that it doesn't somehow resonate with what's going on with the times? That if our time is, if I'm not mistaken, it's in the 20th century we have Nietzsche, God is dead.
Yes.
Which means then order is broken.
Yes.
And therefore music reflects that breaking of order.
for sure. And you look at some of the symphonies of Vaughan Williams, there's dark, bitter, black and white trench warfare going on in those symphonies. In terms of the harmony, you're looking at the 12-tone system. How far could they go with the diatonic, the chromatic element of it? It's chromatic. We're talking about dissonance being concord, so something that sounds pleasing to the ear, which is then going to become challenged by dissonance through chromaticism, but will eventually be resolved. But what if, in the sake of Schoenberg, what if there was no hierarchical nature to those eight notes? You actually took all 12 semitones within that octave and treated them as equals. That's the key thing here. And almost, and I'm not the first person to say this, the 12-tone series, or the second Viennese school as they became known, almost killed music to some extent.
When you say killed music as it was understood then, having a clear melody.
Correct.
Like you say, something you can hum, you can whistle to.
Yes.
But suddenly it is
absolutely
all these semitones. And
yes. And what it was basically a game that they play to some extent. We could, I do it with some of my students. Choose your tone row. So take 1 to 12 in any order and find a row that you are happy with. 7, 8, 1, 3, 12, 11. You cannot repeat any of those numbers. Okay, so that's your tone row. Now you start to write music out with that tone row. And you cannot repeat any of those 12 notes until you've completed your tone row. Now, what they then took that rule, that system, they applied it to dynamics. They applied it to rhythmic cells. They applied it to orchestration as far as they could go, because they thought that this was the natural evolution from Liszt through Debussy, through all that chromatic challenge. This was the way forward. And actually, it was leading us, to some extent, up a cul-de-sac.
If that's the case, then you do make a U-turn.
Yes, absolutely. And that U-turn is actually provided by, because a lot of the composers were still, you've still got people like Poulenc and Puccini, Rachmaninoff. I mean, they're still writing, around this same time. So there was plenty on offer in that sense.
I'm speaking with Kevin Field, and we are talking about modern music, which began at the turn of the 20th century. Some trepidation.
Yeah.
And a period marked by the two great wars and the Great Depression in America. Coming up, more about this music, and we will lead into what is contemporary music. This is Front Row on the Bigger Picture, and I'm Lim Soon Heng, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. You're on Bigger Picture on the Front Row, and I'm Lim Soon Heng, speaking with Kevin Field from Bentley Music Academy. We are on the last of our series on music through time, and today we're talking about modern music, the music that was formed during the period when there was this great war, two great wars, and the Great Depression, a time where there was a lot of introspection as seen through the eyes of Sigmund Freud, that we, in a sense, order as created by God is no longer there. In terms of the intellectual ideas of the West, as Nietzsche said, God is dead. So dissonance in the world reflected in the dissonance of the music created by composers.
Yeah.
What interests me is that when a composer comes up with a piece of music, does the composer also provide the different lines of music by the other instrument?
Yes, except in the case of film music, which we can maybe touch on. Current school of operation for composers who are writing for film is they will write the line, the key line itself, and then hand it down to their copyist, and because they understand the way that author, that composer, will orchestrate, because there's not enough time and there's so much work for those that are lucky. For the absolute composer who is writing music for the sake of writing music, or for the concert platform, the opera hall, et cetera, they are, writing everything. It's their idea, it's their orchestration, and they are aware of the orchestra. So every single line, every single dot of I and cross T, every phrasing, musical instruction, diminuendo, tenuto, ritardando, molto accelerando, all of this is there, is all part of that whole process. They are responsible for that.
You write a piece of music, you have the first violin, you have the second violin.
Yep.
Is the composer writing for the first violin, for the second violin,
at
for the
same time? Yeah, absolutely. And all at the same time, yes. He or she is taking the whole as a vehicle, conduit for communicating that idea in her or his head.
Going back to this Rite of Spring, my understanding is that, for instance, the bassoon was used in such a way, it didn't sound like the bassoon.
No, absolutely. And at the day, that was at the extreme, that top note, was at the extreme of the range of the bassoon. And I think towards the end of Stravinsky's life, he had said, actually, if I knew that most people were going to be able to play it, I would have written it a tone higher. You know, that's wonderful. Yes, it was, that's not how you start a piece. You know, we're used to, pa-pam. We've got used to starting a piece, not as high up in the upper stratosphere of an instrument that's supposed to be down in the basement. So, yeah, challenges of technique, demands from the musician, from the instrumentalists. And, of course, there's a knock-on effect there because composers, and this was Wagner as well, Berlioz, Wagner, you know, they wanted to expand the orchestra. The orchestra continues to grow.
You introduced the idea of getting your students to compose music based on the semitones.
Yeah, the 12-tone, them in. The tone, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Now, what did Schoenberg do that you accused him of leading us to?
I personally accused, not just me. There are other people.
You can assert that, you know, this was kind of music that was leading us down this cul-de-sac.
The answer is in the choice of the people in terms of what it is they prefer to listen to some extent. There's no doubt that with that music, and we're talking about the Second Viennese School, Berg and Webern were his pupils. There's some great operas there, Wozzeck, Lulu. They really challenged, you know, Rodjak style. They put the 12-tone style with the big romantic lush sound orchestra. They really challenged that. There's an argument for that music existing in its own right. But because we're so used to the 1-5 and back to 1, what I'm talking about is whatever key you're in, let's call it C major, you're going to go away as far as you can to G major and back again in a sonata form. And we're so used to that journey that gives us we're going over there, we'll go to 5, we'll have an argument over there, we'll come back and resolve ourselves and find ourselves all together in the home key. That was all gone, as I say, with every single 12 note within that chromatic scale being treated as equal. So to some extent, and this is a sweeping statement, because if you listen to Transfigured Night, or if you listen to Piero Lunaire, which is with a small ensemble, a sextet, and a mezzo-soprano, doing a Sprechstimme, so like spoken speech, half singing, half speaking, half rapping kind of thing. If you listen to that music, there's no doubt that that is romantic music, but using these 12 tones. Schoenberg basically wasn't the first person. If you look to use the 12-tone, if you go back to Liszt and the Grand Gallop Chromatique from the Death Dance or the Faust Symphony, there are phrases used there which are just purely 12-tone. And even now, the people that are using standard Western harmonic form, they will often use elements of the 12-tone technique in their compositions. Shostakovich, for example. They were limited. They were limited because they couldn't, because of the restrictions they placed on themselves. They actually wanted more freedom, but actually they found that they could not go to some extent any further. Then what, to some extent, you had the extreme opposition to all of this complexity. You had something called minimalism. And this is where the composers got rid of everything. They got rid of the melody that you want to be singing when you're in humming as you come out of the concert hall. They got rid of that. To some extent, they got rid of harmony as well and took it right back to rhythm, just pure rhythm. There's a couple of pieces, both by Steve Reich. One is called Music for Pieces of Wood, which is for 5 players. And the other is called Clapping Music. And that is for a duet, 2 people clapping. They use a system called phasing, which is technology, using a bit of technology, which people can now do on the computers on their garage band or whatever, they can cut and splice and move something, a quaver. But in those days, they didn't have that technology. They would actually use record players to some extent. They would actually have 12 people lining up, putting a needle on the record, one beat out at the time, you know, and then having this sort of mess of sound and noise, if you like. But with minimalist music, they were getting back to the sheer, pure communication of rhythm. It was free of emotion, free of melody, free of harmony, and coming back to rhythm. And the clapping music basically has a rhythm that goes... round and round and round. That's one player. They both start like this. And then the composer phases it one quaver out. So there's one player moves one quaver. So that's 6-4. In 6-4, so six means there are six main beats of crotchets. You divide each of those quarters, into eighth notes. You divide those in half. So you've got 12 quavers. Bear with me. You've got 12 quavers in a bar of 6-4. And so you've got the opportunity to have 12 different variations on one theme. And where do you end up? You end up at the beginning. So 12 tone, fantastic, great. Then the reaction is minimalism. Come back to the bare basics, and we're still using sonata form. It's still there. You know, a lot of people would have a problem if they didn't have the movie in front of them or the dancer in front of them listening to it. But look, lots of people go to the movies on a regular basis. There are plenty of excellent film scores. They are quite challenging to listen to in their own right. But we sort of don't value them because we've got the life support of the visual to get us through. If you took that music in its own right out, it would sound like an extreme piece of Stravinsky, for example. The film music, Hans Zimmer, Interstellar, the music he writes for that is extraordinary, and it's this tick-tock all the way through his music in that piece of music, just like Prokofiev in Romeo and Juliet. There's a tick-tock, tick-tock. It's challenging music, but because you've got the film, you've got the life support. The challenge for the audience, and then it's just an orchestra, just with a small J, just an orchestra playing. So the challenge there is the box office commercial influence.
I mean, what's interesting, when Rite of Spring first premiered, it premiered as music that went with a ballet.
Yes.
It was not just music standing alone.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
And I wonder how much of that is in some ways like, you know, when we think of film music, as you're saying, there is that visual to accompany it.
Mm.
That, I assume, yes, would make it a little bit more accessible.
Yes. We did a project called Real Composers, so R-E-E-L, back in the day with MPO. And we took the same 10 minutes film footage from a Malay film, which I sadly cannot remember the name of that. And we put three composers to the same 10-minute visual, and how that visual changed, because you've got three different interpretations of that visual. Every performance was different. And we've done that with dance as well, with Yi Ka Ho, who I was hoping to be joining us today, but sadly he's busy teaching his next generation of wonderful students. He has an excellent score, and this is something that our listeners must be aware of. There are hundreds of Malaysian composers writing wonderful, superb music. They are alive today, and they don't get a chance to be performed on a regular basis. This is such a shame. And there's such talent out there. Of course, they're being performed everywhere else, but not necessarily being performed in Malaysia these days, which is such a shame.
And it's because the music is difficult?
No. I think it's a question of there not being enough spaces, logistical spaces, not enough financial support for the artist to be able to express themselves in that way. There's a challenge. That challenge, as I say, would have been faced by Beethoven, Berlioz, Mahler.
Well, you run a music academy.
I knew it was going to come back. Yeah.
that then becomes your responsibility to have a standing orchestra that will play locally composed music.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, absolutely right, yeah.
But we need to come back to what we're talking about, modern music, which leads to contemporary music. And when you were talking about minimalist music, Philip Glass is the name that I think about when, you know, the minimalist music is mentioned. What is characteristic of his music that when we listen to it, we say, okay, that's what it is he's doing?
Repetition. That repetition is key, especially with Asian music. If you're listening to gamelan music, for example, there's a tremendous amount of repetition in that, and those big cycles, which are then represented or designated by the gong a gong, you know, in that sense, there's that big, huge, oh, there we are, that's our time frame. Okay, repetition, which has not featured in the Western art form until the 20th century in that sense. Everything is through that sonata form. We are seeking an answer to something. We're challenging and debating, etc., musically, abstractly in that way. With the minimalist composers like Philip Glass and Steve Reich, as we just mentioned, they're using repetition, enormous repetition, and then a certain simplicity with the melodic form and the harmony. We're also sort of going back to, well, we're not going back to, we're doing what the rock and roll bands do currently, which is use chord 1-4-5. And you can be a one-hit wonder with those three chords and make a lot of money. Thank you very much. See you later. He's doing that and putting that template onto the orchestral form. There's a piece that would be interesting for listeners to track down. It's called In C, and it's by Terry Riley. Any ensemble can play it. Any orchestration with voices at any level. It's one sheet of A4 paper. You can download it. It's in the public domain. In C, Terry Riley. Download it. Play it with any group, school, community level, whatever. And 54, 56 variations. In C goes around in G and comes back to C. And it starts off with somebody just playing C, 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 just like that. That's the quaver. That is a metronome, goes on all the way through the piece. Now, these very simple ideas, these very simple pieces, and then basically it's a bit of a game. You can start at cell number one, idea number one, and go to cell number two, number three, and then everybody, almost like a shifting canon, goes through from 1 to 54, 56 variations together, but no more than 3 or 4 cells apart. What is that all about? That's about listening. So every performance, a bit like jazz, every performance is going to be different. You can go to In C on a Thursday night, it's going to be completely different, the next night. That's an amazing thing to listen to and perform, and very, very difficult, very challenging. But it's repetition. The key point here is repetition.
Where is music going?
Look, I listen to one of my favorite programs on BFM is Into the Blue, and on a Saturday night. And I think if you take somewhere between the Muddy Confluence and Into the Blue, it's going in that direction. What would Mozart be doing now? I think he'd be improvising jazz. He would probably be in Radiohead. Bach would be in Radiohead. You listen to the forms of Radiohead, the timbre of bands like that, experimental electronic, because that's something we haven't really touched upon. We just don't have time to cover everything, the experimental, the electronic music in that sense. But there's an influence on... Do you remember that piece way back when it started? Ha, 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 ha. Back in the 70s. You're old enough, Soon-Heng, to remember that piece. Oh, Superman. Who was that? Anderson. Laurie Anderson. Is it Laurie Anderson? That's a minimalist piece of music. In the UK, it got to number one back in 17, something or other. So electronic music, rock bands, yes. You listen to some of the music that they play on Into the Blue.
Well, technology is changing music.
Yes, it is. Yes.
Radically.
Yes, and making it accessible to all. You can sample your own voice or your own furniture or your own drums and rubbish and bins and start to make music. Anybody can do it to some extent.
Where is opera going?
You.
Are we coming up with new operas?
Yes. Listen to Thomas Addis. Addes with an accent over the E. Thomas Addis. And listen to some of his operas. They're quite extreme. Listen, as we mentioned before, about the...
Nixon.
Nixon in China and Klinghoffer, which was the hijacking of the ship there and the assassinations in that sense. So, I mean... Quite brutal topic subjects, but that's the life we live in. We are living in that life, and music and art is reflecting that, and music is not left out of that world.
When we talk about music, on the other side, pop music, does the kind of, quote, serious music reflect more the times, or does pop music reflect more of the times?
That's a really good question. I would say both, but I can't prove it because we're not able to perform enough contemporary music of the Western art form in that sense of the orchestral scene. There's a lot of fantastic music being written out there, and it's cutting edge, and it's vital, it's relevant. We are just not able to listen to enough of it to get used to the language. We've had 400 or 500 years to get used to Bach, Beethoven, Berlioz. You can't expect people to suddenly like something that someone's written a few weeks ago and the ink is still wet on the paper in that sense. If they're challenging the forms and the norms, if they're writing to suit commercial or a film, they're going to use a little bit of this and a little bit of that, a little bit of experimentation, but also standard notation. But that's a really good question. A bit of both, I'd say. And that's not a cop-out.
We have mentioned some of the major composers of the 20th century. Who are some that we tend to overlook and not get to listen?
Well, I do have my Chopin list again with me. See what I did there? So the extremes are massive, especially if I said to you that Gershwin was writing at this time. So you've got the all-black Porgy and Bess opera. We know those songs, Summertime. William Walton, Ligeti, Lutosławski, Polish composer. Fantastic.
William Walton, who wrote the Henry V.
Yeah. Music to Henry V, absolutely. Lutosławski, Gorecki, Edward Elgar, so a bit of nationalism, but that tag was thrown at him, I'm afraid to say. Fauré, Nielsen, a superb composer, amazing symphonies. Penderecki, Poulenc, we've mentioned before. Schnittke, have a listen to Schnittke. He wrote a piece called Not a Midsummer's Night Dream. That's the translation for it. And he takes a little bit of Mendelssohn.
Who wrote about Midsummer
Night's
Dream?
Yes. Now, not exactly transcribed. He remembered it, I think he says, as he remembers, as he recalls it. And he basically spray paints over it. He graffitis over this wonderful Mendelssohn-like theme with 12 tones. Absolutely extraordinary. Absolutely. Shostakovich, you cannot ignore Shostakovich and his 15 string quartets and his 15 symphonies and how he survived. You're talking about a composer that had a suitcase permanently packed by his bed just in case he disappeared. He was asked to leave and go to the salt mines. Incredible, incredible music. What he would have written after Symphony No. 4 if he was left to his own devices, goodness only knows.
Yeah, because we didn't talk about the events in Russia. No, Stalin.
Yeah, absolutely. And that control of music as a means of communication, which then has a connection to minimalist music and cubism. There's too much.
Well, thank you very much. I'm appreciative of your generosity, of your information, and of your time, Kevin.
You're more than welcome. It's been an absolute pleasure. And I hope we've given some people an opportunity to just delve a little deeper.
Yeah, maybe next year we'll think of something else, how to approach talking about music. I treat this as my own education because I have this big gap myself. This marks the end of our series, Music Through Time. And of course, I'm very, very grateful to Kevin Field from Bentley Music Academy, Malaysia, for generously giving his time and knowledge. If you have any questions about music or any of the other arts, write to biggerpicture@bfm.my and we'll find someone to respond to your questions. This is Front Row of the Bigger Picture and I'm Lim Soon Heng, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.